For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, a long chat with Josie Lloyd about her books, The Cancer Ladies Running Club, Come Together, and her new book, Life Saving for Beginners. Plus, fresh from the Booker shortlist party, we'll be finding out from Neil McGregor, head judge, what those shortlisted books are. Josie Lloyd has been an author for 25 years with her debut novel It Could Be You, entering the world in 1997, followed up by Come Together, written with her husband, Emlyn Rees. She joined me on the show to talk about the stormy waters in her new book, Life Saving for Beginners, and we will get onto that later. We'll also get onto the novel Come Together, which I'm fairly sure I made half of the audio version of when I worked at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. First of all, though, we talked about the Cancer Ladies Running Club. The RNIB version is read by Jilly Bond.
We set off around the park, but it's tough. Tamsin's pace is much faster than I'd normally run, meaning she really must have just run a long way that first time I saw her. How far was she planning on making us run now? It's funny how life can suddenly change. You can coast along for years doing the same thing, and then, plop, one day you're well, the next you've got cancer. Or you can be a couch potato, and then, poof, just like that, you're running. Except that it's hard. I'm way, way too unfit for this. Very soon my head is screaming. I can't do it. I can't do this. This is so hard. I need to stop. I have to stop. At the top of the path, after about 200 metres, I slow down, panting. Dad, I had no idea it'd be this hard, I say quietly, heaving forward, my hands on my knees. Tamsin stops and comes back for me. Amar jogs on the spot. She's not even lightly perspiring. What's the matter?
I'm slowing you down. Please, go on without me.
I wave my hand to the path ahead. It's still hard to breathe.
Nonsense, she says.
I give her a look. How many times do you go upstairs a day? Or actually sit down to relax? She's got a point. I am on the go pretty much constantly at home, not to mention the fact that I never, ever sit down at work.
Stop being up here, Kira.
She taps her head and her rings clank. Running is all mental, you see. Once you understand that, the rest is easy. It's one foot in front of the other. Just shut your head up and tell yourself you're going to do it. End of.
Jilly Bond reading from the RNIB version of the Cancer Ladies Running Club. Josie Lloyd joined me to talk about the book.
Well, this book is very close to my heart, actually, and came about when I had a surprise diagnosis for breast cancer about 5 years ago. I was called up randomly to have a mammogram, and it was picked up. So incredibly fortunately, it was picked up early, but I had a mastectomy and all the treatment. And my first instinct was to look for a book, because I've always turned to literature in times of crisis, but I also find making sense of the world through literature a very big part of my life. And I tried to find a book, and I couldn't really find one. I didn't want to have, I've been writing books for 25 years with happy endings. And I was like, where is my book that's going to tell me that everything's going to be okay? I wanted to know what I was in for, but to not read about mums dying with tubes up their noses. I didn't want to read that. So, and I couldn't really find anything that wasn't using cancer as a really kind of doom and gloom thing. And going through the whole process really made me realise that there's enormous stigma attached to cancer. I mean, you tell people that you've got diabetes or heart disease and they say, see you down the pub. But if you tell people you've got cancer, they act as if you're about to die any second. And the stigma I felt attached to being ill with cancer was really profound. And I thought, well, we need to do some debunking, because one in two of us will get cancer in our lifetimes and one in eight women get breast cancer. So I felt there was a huge need to write a fictional story. And so I'd started writing a diary through the whole thing, and I'd sort of journaled through the whole experience. And I mean, to be honest, being a very vain author, by the end of it, I had like 80,000 words of quite good copy. So I said to my agent, you know, could I turn this into something? And at first it felt very much like a memoir, and I didn't want it to be a memoir. And then I rewrote it loads of times to try and remove it from my experience to make it into a fictional experience. And Kira, the woman in the story, is very much like me. She was the same age as me. I was 48. She has three kids. She runs a business. And I just wanted to make her this kind of every woman, and to really examine how a breast cancer diagnosis affects your marriage, your kids, your life, your status with your friends, your business. And the story grew from that. And I wrote it, and then I rewrote it. And then, of course, COVID hit. So it didn't get published for another year. But actually, honestly, it's been the most joyous writing experience, because came out in America, and I've just had messages from people all over the place just telling me how much it's meant to them to read this story. And I think that's what fiction needs to be, that you hold up a mirror and people can find themselves in what they're reading. And it's been really wonderful and very humbling and very lovely to hear from all these women saying that it's really helped them. And I've written the film script of it, which is very exciting. So I'm hoping, it's got a really good production company on, so I'm really hoping that it's going to get made next year as a film, which will be great. So yeah, so that's how it came about. But also it came about that one of the things that happened was when I was first diagnosed, I met this woman, Roz, at the school gates, and she said, "You've got to keep fit." And I said, "No, Roz, I'm going under the duvet with the chocolate biscuits." And she said, no, come and meet my running group. So I went down to the seafront, and I met this group of runners who were all going through cancer treatment, and they were brilliant and funny, and they had this real sense of gallows humor, and I always look for the funny in things. So actually they were the people who kind of really inspired me to write the story. So that's how it came about. And, you know, it's about a woman who joins a running group, and it goes from there.
You've sort of answered this question, but was that quite a cathartic novel to write, one you felt you had to write?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just, you know, you have to write a story. And actually during that whole period, I was joining this running group, and then about 3 weeks in, I was down the seafront in Brighton, where I live, and there was a guy from the press there, and he said, "Oh, it's so great you're running the Brighton Marathon 10K. And I said, "The what? The what? And Roz said, "Oh, didn't I tell you this was a training group for the Brighton Marathon 10K? And I was like, "No, you really didn't." Anyway, so I landed up running the Brighton Marathon 10K just before my third chemo. So I was completely bald, and I was running it, and I was like, "Oh God, this is so hard. What on earth am I doing?" And as I took my cap off and I was running bald and I was hot and sweaty, and I was thinking, "This is ridiculous. Why am I even attempting this?" Woman after woman came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder and went, "Keep going, I'm clear 5 years. Keep going, I'm clear 10 years. Keep going, I'm clear 3 years." And I was like buoyed up by this enormous wave of support. And then this one woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, I was a goner, you know, everybody thought I was, you know, never going to make it." And I ran all the way through my treatment. And, you know, she said, "Keep going." And then on the very last turn of the race, she'd waited for me and she said, "I want to tell you something." And I said, "What is it?" She said, "Well, when I was going through my treatment, I was at my really lowest ebb. And this woman in a cafe came over to me and said, 'Look, I know how you're feeling, but I've been there, and I want you to know that your life can be better than ever the other side of cancer.'" And she'd taken off this little butterfly necklace and then given it to this woman in the race, and said, "This is your little butterfly of hope, and I want you to wear it, and one day you can pass it on." And this woman said to me, "I've been wearing this necklace for 3 years, and now it's time to pass it on, and I'm passing it on to you, and now it's your little butterfly of hope, and I want you to wear it and know that your life is going to be better than ever the other side of cancer." And we had like a few tears and a hug, and I've never known her name. And she gave me this necklace that I wear every day. And it was such an inspiring story. And it was at that moment, I suddenly felt, "Oh my goodness, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to get through this. I'm going to be thriving the other side, not surviving, only be thriving. And that's what happened. And so that really inspired me to write the story. And so I had to write it. You know, when life gives you a story like that, you have to write it, you know, if you're a novelist. So that's what happened.
I heave myself upright. Really? That's the trick? Yeah, it's simple. Just chop the run into bite-sized pieces. Tell yourself that you're going to run to that bush, then that tree, and each time you hit your marker, congratulate yourself. Bloody well done, me. I laugh at her effusiveness. I'm serious, she continues. Tell yourself that if you really must, you can stop for a bit, but before you do, assess whether there's more juice in the tank. There always is, believe me. So then you go to your next marker, and before you know it, you'll see our bench and you'll have done something you couldn't do before. We're only doing 3K, that's all. All? Just believe you're going to do it. You might not enjoy it the first time, but next time you will. Come on, we'll chat. It'll be fine, you'll see.
Now, you said it's just come out in America. Has it come out in America under a different name?
Yes, it's come out as the Brightside Running Club. They were a bit... it's difficult with titles of books because you go round and round the houses with titles. And in the UK, I felt that it should really be the Cancer Ladies Running Club, mainly because the women that I ran with, we kind of were a bit like, we're the Cancer Ladies. You know, we were being ironic about the whole thing. We wouldn't call ourselves ladies per se. But anyway, having cancer in the title of a book is a bold move. And it did well here, but in America, it's a kind of slightly different market. And so we called it the Brightside Running Club, which has worked much better. And I think the film will be called the Brightside Running Club. But yeah, so it came out there. So it's a different title. But that often happens with books, that they have different titles in America. It seems culturally quite similar, but quite often it's not. So with quite a lot of books over the years, they've had to change title.
Now on to Josie's new book, Life Saving for Beginners. The commercial version and the one in the RNIB Talking Books Library is read by Lucy Scott.
The tide is going out, and there's a sea mist making everything slightly blurry when Claire joins Helga and Dominika on the beach. They must know something we don't, Claire says as she puts her bag down. The surfers, clad in black, are floating on the still water by the burnt-out pier. There's not even the hint of a wave. What are they doing? Tor comes down from the prom to join them, her feet sliding in the slope of pebbles. Apart from their gang and the surfers in the distance, there's nobody around, except for the man she can see stretching on the bandstand next to a tent. Not a very relaxing place to pitch up, she shouldn't imagine. Look! Helga points towards the groin, to where there's a small brown bird on the pebbles. It's a turnstone. Claire watches as it picks over a shell, then looks up to check that nobody has seen it, then puts its head down again. If Helga hadn't pointed it out, she'd have never noticed it. She can see that the bird is torn between the world at its feet and the world around it. It's fascinating to watch. In the water, they all set off in a slow swim, parallel to the shore. It's taken a will of steel, but Claire's proud of herself for getting in with a minimum of fuss, like Helga. She watches her gloves beneath the surface, still hardly able to believe they're hers. She's got the neoprene boots and gloves online, and she feels more like she belongs now she has the right kit.
Now, moving on to Life Saving for Beginners, tell us about the seagulls.
Oh, well, it's about right about what you know, really, isn't it? During COVID, I was writing another book called Love in the Death Cafe. That was the working title, all about a death cafe and about how we never talk about death and how we have a very sort of closed off attitude to talking about death. And it was, again, lifting the lid on something that I wanted to talk about. And then COVID hit. And I was like, oh, no. All we are talking about is death. And it was really difficult to write a contemporary fiction novel during that time about that subject. So I kind of abandoned ship. And I live really near the sea in Brighton, and I always swim in the summer. But then I just carried on all the way through. And before I knew it, I kind of swam in the winter. And I was swimming with this group of women. And when lockdown hit, it was just such a brilliant thing because you know, the lockdown rules are not as imposing on the beach because it's a wide open space. And we would go down and kind of meet and go in the sea. And oh, it's just magic. And I really started feeling this huge affinity to the sea at the end of my road that I hadn't really felt before. And I wanted to then to sort of write about what lockdown had given us rather than what it had taken away, which was about this sense of community and a big and profound appreciation of nature, which I think happened for a lot of people during lockdown. And so the Seagulls came about sort of inspired by my own group of swimmers. And I'm on various WhatsApp groups. We're called things like the Splash and Bobbers because we're not terribly a couple of swimmers. We just go in for a bob and a chat. We've got the seabirds, the salty seabirds, which are the main group in Brighton. And their membership has gone up from, you know, a few hundred to thousands and thousands, you know, nearly 10,000 during lockdown. And people, women all across the country are sort of taking to the sea because it's incredibly efficacious and good for you. And more research is coming out about cold water swimming and how very good it is for your mental health and for your well-being. So, you know, I'm 53 now. And, you know, for ladies of a certain age, Robert, it's very good for certain, it's just like hot flushes and things like that. So that's why I started writing about, and I wanted to write about women that don't really often get a look in fiction, you know, women who are going through difficult times and older women. And I've got a kind of group of very eclectic people who meet the Salty Seagulls, and they form a kind of tribe. And the story is about Maddie, whose life explodes on Christmas Day. And she discovers her husband's having an affair with one of her friends, and her estranged son, who has had a bit of a tricksy past with drugs, is missing. And she discovers that he's down in Brighton on Christmas Day. So she throws her toys out of the car and she leaves the family home and she comes to Brighton to look for her son. But of course, it's lockdown, so none of the hotels are open. So she finds this really grotty Airbnb and she's completely capsized in her life. And she just doesn't really know what she's doing. And she's been this incredible Instagrammer, and she's been Instagramming her beautiful home and her whole life, and her whole sense of home and security is completely stripped away. And she starts to look for her son, and then she meets the seagulls on the beach and they persuade her into the sea, and her life completely changes as a result of meeting this group of women. So it's about friendship and it's about community, but you know, some dark issues in there as well about homelessness and about mental health and about bereavement. So and tackling difficult subjects again, but with hopefully with a light touch and a bit of humour.
She swoops down and rejoins her corporal self as she plucks the car keys from the reclaimed console table in the hall and swings her tote onto her shoulder. Slamming the wood and glass front door as hard as she possibly can, she notes that the wreath that she made by hand, which got over 1,000 likes on her feed, has sprung off the door in solidarity and tumbled to the floor. She stalks out to the Porsche Cayenne on the gravel drive, opens the door and gets in, only realising then that she's still in her UGG slippers. It's no matter. Her gym kit is in the boot. Trent is on the front doorstep shouting, but she doesn't wind down the window as he kicks the wreath. A string of lights, one of the 20 that Maddie put up single-handedly, falls, and he battles with it like Indiana Jones being attacked by a snake. She beeps the electric gates and drives out of the driveway. The white-hot anger still radiates from her. She turns out of the lane and heads south. She's going to find her son.
Yeah, Maddie seems like a typical Instagrammer in that she like takes photographs of a beautiful dining table and then they eat on paper plates and they're snug.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not a massive fan of social media. As an author, you have to be on social media, but oh Robert, I can't bear it really. It's not my thing. Also, I am famously bad at taking pictures. I mean, I have albums full of the backs of my children's heads. I'm rubbish at anything visual. I just, you know, I'm good at words and I like writing stories and I like chatting, but you know, you have to be quite good to be kind of an Instagram. And even though Instagram designed for idiot photographers like me who can't, you know, sort out a picture, I still can't bear that kind of whole humble braggy kind of thing that goes on Instagram. And I really wanted to explore that with Maddie, that she's completely caught herself in this enormous trap that is just getting bigger and bigger. And of course, she wants to make some money out of it. And to make money out of being an influencer or being on Instagram, you know, it takes a phenomenal amount of effort. And it seems like an easy thing, but it's really not, because you have to really think about all your followers and what you're doing. So it's this huge chain that she's got round her neck of just trying to be this person all the time. And of course, when she really realizes that she's not the person and it's not a perfect home, and you know, she's got this at home made blog, and she's made this, she's raised this horrible house that was on this piece of land, and she's built this beautiful home from scratch, and she's Instagrammed the whole thing, but it's not a home because her husband and her are very estranged, and her son, they've had a massive argument with their son and he's moved out, and so it's not a home. And so I wanted to sort of talk about home from that point of view, but also about homelessness, because of course we see a lot of that down in Brighton. But you know, I did a lot of research on homeless charities and about Rough Sleepers and about the issues that people are involved in. And actually what's really shocking is how many people, through no real fault of their own, fall through the cracks. And any of us are only a couple of really bad bits of luck away from losing everything. And it's, and when you sit, hear people's stories and you hear what's happened to people, and you realise, you know, the facade that we all have, that we all have aspired to, these very comfortable, happy homes, is, you know, it's very easily taken away. So I wanted to kind of look at the contrasts of that and sort of explore that a bit, which was really, really enlightening to do and quite humbling. Actually, there's quite a lot of things that I found out in people that I talked to, which, you know, people who were really, really caught in a bind that was no real fault of their own particularly. And it's tricksy, you know, when you see that.
Now, the presenter who used to be on this show was blind, but I could tell when he hadn't had his daily swim in the Hampstead ponds. Gets really antsy if he doesn't get in the water. Are you the same?
Yeah, but I just went in this morning. I just came back from my holiday. I've got in Mallorca, and I really missed the sea. So I went down with the dog this morning and jumped in the sea, which was just amazing. And I got in the sea, I was like, ah. But it was down to Red, actually, after my chat with him about Council Ladies Running Club. And we had a long chat afterwards about Hampstead and swimming. And it was down to him that I put one of the scenes in the book, which is set in Hampstead. And it was all down to him and our chat after this podcast that was to do with the swimming and the sea. And it was really fascinating, his view of kind of swimming. And he loved, you know, he really loves it. But I think once you, I think one of the things about swimming in cold water is that it invokes your inner superhero. So you wake up in the morning and it's horrible and dark outside and cold and miserable, and you go, there is absolutely no way I'm leaving this duvet. And then you get on the group chat and everybody's kind of feeling the same way, and we kind of goad each other into going. And then you kind of get all your kit together and it's dark and you go down to the seafront and you're like, I'm still not going to get in the sea. And then you just go, it's only cold water. And as soon as you get to the sea, even if you've got your toes almost really nearly, very nearly at the beginning of the waves or the beginning of the pool, you're still going, there's still a big bit of you that's going, no way, no way am I going to do this. And then you do it and then you feel amazing. And then you just go, well, if I've overcome that, you know, you're quids in for the rest of the day, or you're already a winner, you know? Mm. So, and it does invoke your in a superhero, because you just feel a little bit invincible. So it does, you do sort of take that through to the rest of your day. You do find yourself kind of being a little bit braver than maybe you would have been. Just this incredible mental reset, because you can't really focus on anything else apart from swimming. And actually, that the moment you get into the water, it is a kind of baptism in a way. So everything that's going on in your life suddenly is completely put on hold for those moments that you're in the water.
And it's the first book that we've featured on the show that addresses COVID and lockdown directly.
Yes, and I didn't want to do it with too heavy a touch, because actually when I was writing it, you know, everyone said, well, you can't write a book about COVID, because once COVID's over, everybody's going to want to forget about COVID, which is true. You know, we have kind of moved on from it. But it was important that it was truthful about kind of the experience of what it was like living in Brighton and being a swimmer in the sea and the lockdown happening. And the story happens and all the things that happen to the character and those characters and their emotional development would have happened anyway without lockdown. So lockdown sort of features, it's set in a sort of lockdowny place, but you know, I didn't kind of really, you know, I wanted to do it in a kind of light way, but I'm not kind of shy away from the fact that we went through COVID. And a lot of people wrote books at that time and pretended that it hadn't happened. And if you are writing a contemporary fiction novel about people who are fictionally living right now, you do have to acknowledge what's going on, I think. So it was important to me to include it. Whether it dates the book, I don't know. I mean, we'll see, but it's not really mentioned that much. It's kind of just in the background.
But I think all books are dated. I remember reading It Could Be You or Come Together 20-odd years ago. You know, it's like your books have grown up beside you, you know.
I know. And it's really funny, Come Together, because Emlyn and I wrote, my husband and I wrote together, and we got together as a result of writing this book together. So he wrote the boy's point of view and I wrote the girl's point of view of a relationship. But it's set in 1998, came out in 1999. But it's before the era of mobile phones. So it's unbelievably dated. And actually somebody contacted me from a university and said, oh, we're doing a module on 90s culture and we want to use Come Together as, you know, source material. I was like, wow, I wouldn't really exactly say that that's academic material. But it's really funny. And I can remember Amy writing this piece about Amy, my character, wandering around Shepherd's Bush roundabout. And she's making, you know, she's wandering about, but there's no mobile phones and stuff. And she's pondering about the fact that she's left a message on his answer phone machine in his house. And of course, it's all the comedy of leaving a terrible message on somebody's answering machine, which is a total anathema to people now. You know, my children have a clue about what that meant. So yeah, it's very funny. Yeah, it's a very funny thing and very dated, and it could be, it was incredibly dated. So, but I like writing contemporary fiction. I like writing about kind of being observational about kind of where we're up to and culturally where we're up to. I think it's important.
So much for my great expectations. I've had it all and lost it all in a day. In years to come, when I'm sitting in my flat like Miss Havisham covered in cobwebs, people will say, ah, yes, poor thing. She was happy that one June day, but that was her lot. And even though Jack hasn't died, he might as well be on the moon. I'm torturing myself with what he's saying right now. Amy, yeah, she's a good lay. We had a laugh, but there's plenty more where that came from. Onwards and upwards. When should I see her again? My friends are more important, and I want to be young, free, and single. What's the point of being tied down? This is intolerable. I can't stay in bed with his voice in the room, and I drag my bones into the kitchen to make a hot chocolate. I sniff the milk. It'll do. It's only when I close the fridge that I notice that my kids' magnetic letters have been moved. And there it is, in pink, green and orange. Amy, you are top. I push my face against the white door and smile, because the message can only be from Jack. Whilst I'm standing here waiting for the milk to boil, I don't feel quite so bad.
New dawn. My morning begins with a riddle. Question: what smells like cheese, tastes like cheese, but isn't cheese? Answer: Matt's foot. Now, Matt's a nice guy. Correction. Matt's the best guy. We've been through a lot together, from childhood piano lessons in Bristol with the untamed child-hating shrew Miss Hopkins, to puberty and our first purchase of dirty magazines and cheap cider, to our current preoccupation with masquerading as mature, responsible members of society in London. And I can say without doubt that there aren't many sacrifices I wouldn't be happy to make in his interest. If I only had one cigarette left in my pack and we were miles from any shop, I'd share it with him. If he fell overboard in a storm, I'd dive in after him. If he needed a kidney, I'd give him one of mine. And if pressed, I would give him my last Rolo. But even the very best of friendships only goes so far. And waking up to find the sweaty big toe of his left foot wedged firmly against my teeth is, quite frankly, too far.
A clip of Come Together, narrated there by Rachel Atkins and David Thorpe.
I think I made the RNIB audio version of Come Together.
I think I did one.
It was one of those books that a male narrator did the male parts and a female narrator did the female parts. And they were, I think they were done at separate times. But it was one of those books where you were reading half of it for work and you had to read the other half for pleasure to see the other side of the conversation. Yeah. Talking of audiobooks, Lifesaving for Beginners is read by Lucy Scott. Do you have any choice in the narrators?
Well, they send you, the publishers send you a choice usually of three narrators, and you're kind of giving a very small window of opportunity to choose them. And quite a lot of voice actors who are doing narrations are very skilled. So then you get a tiny snippet of a book that they've done and you listen to it and you kind of have to go, oh, does she sound like Maddie? Could she do the, you know, the voices? And I love it. So, but you never know how it's going to turn out. And I find it really difficult to listen to my own books in Audible just because I've written them in my own voice and I've got my own voices for my own characters. So sometimes there's a bit of a clash. I think Lucy did quite a good job. I've listened to a snippet of it and it's good, but it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's a very personal thing. And I listen to audiobooks and sometimes I love them and love the narrators. And then sometimes I read it and I just think that's entirely the wrong narrator for that story. So I don't know, it's hard, isn't it? What do you think? Do you find it difficult when you listen to books and you just think the narrator is wrong?
Sometimes I've had to, I mean, it used to be my job, but sometimes I've had to say to narrators, like, calm down, you know, just hint at the accent, because Lucy's not only playing Maddie, but she's also playing Dominica and Helga and even Jamie as well. And, you know, you're playing every part. So
it's quite a skill. I mean, it's a real skill, I have to say.
Yeah, so it's basically a one-man or a one-woman show where you're playing all the parts. So I think subtlety is the key. You said you've written it in your own voice. You not fancy narrating it yourself?
Oh, no, Robert. If you speak to Evelyn, you will find out I am a really, really shocking actress. I mean, I could do many things, but, you know, I don't think so. I mean, I don't mind. I would like to have a go maybe one day, but it's a skill that I think I should leave to the professionals, because it is a real skill to be able to read somebody else's book. And also, I'm not convinced that I wouldn't read my own work and then change it as I went along. So I don't think you're allowed to do that. But if it was me reading my own work, I would edit it as I go along, maybe. But it is an interesting thing, because the way you write and the way people speak are different. And actually, back in the day when we used to write novels, so they would be recorded on tapes, first of all, and then CDs, as you remember, and you would get them from the libraries. But it wasn't such a huge thing. And publishers were a bit dismissive, but like, oh, yeah, you've sold the audio rights, and it wasn't a big deal. But now Audible is huge for many people. And I'm really pleased to see that. But it's how you write something and how you would speak it out is a slightly and quite subtly different thing. So now, quite often, I have to read my work aloud. So as I write, I will have to read the first bit aloud, because you would speak it in a different way to how you would read it. A subtle difference as a writer. And I think many authors are becoming much more audible focused in their writing. So we're seeing a lot of books that have got a lot more dialogue in them, a lot shorter chapters, a lot more points of view. So they're becoming more dynamic novels, I think.
What do you reckon? Tor asks Helga as she arrives, putting down her bag and already toe-heeling off her canvas shoes. Helga can always predict the temperature of the sea within 1 degree and can tell which way the tide is going and the current is running. But today is a little confusing. The sea is a foaming mass of clashing peaks. She puts her nose up, feeling the wind on her face. Southwesterly, coming up to a 4 on the wind scale, she reckons. It's a bit rough, don't you reckon? Dominica asks. Helga nods. I agree. Let's pilch it. Now we're here. She changes quickly, and together they walk to the water's edge, where the waves are breaking, fighting each other to reach the beach, overlapping and jostling like boys in a playground around a football. The gulls caw overhead, wings out, stationary as they ride the wind. Helga sits down on the stones and leans back on her elbows, as if she's on a sun lounger. She nods at Tor, who follows her lead and sits on the cold stones. They're freezing under her bum. She likes pilcharding, though. It's the best way of getting soaked and enjoying the benefit of going in the sea without swimming. Up close, the stones glisten in the weak sunshine. Tan and brown and black, they seem to chatter as the sea moves them. At eye level, the sea is a busy torrent of foam. She braces herself for the next wave, gripping onto the shore, the backwash dragging her in, as if the sea is trying to claim her.
She is boisterous today.
Suddenly, a much larger wave rolls over Tor, and she's tussled in its clutches, the water going up her nose.
It's like being in a washing machine,
she gasps, coming up for air. But she's laughing, the water plastering her long purple hair in fronds across her face, like seaweed. Dominica has been dragged in with the backwash. She finds her footing, but only just as another wave hits.
I've got pebbles where no pebbles should ever go,
she says, laughing, when Tor finally reaches her. Walking, even in this knee-deep water, makes them both look like they are dragging 10-ton weights behind them. They hold hands with Helga too and pull her away from the clutches of the next wave. Helga loves seeing Dominika's face light up with that knockout smile of hers. The mix of laughter and the sea is the best medicine she knows. They lie down again where the waves lick the shore, giggling like little children. Helga splashes her arms, then lifts them up, unwittingly gulping in seawater as the next wave hits her in the face. But she doesn't care. This is magic.
Life Saving for Beginners is available in print, ebook, and audio now, as narrated by Lucy Scott. The same version is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it's joined by many other Jussie Lloyd books, including The Cancer Ladies Running Club and, of course, Come Together, read by Rachel Atkins and David Thorpe, and written by Jussie Lloyd with Emlyn Rees. And Jussie, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be on the podcast.
And Jussie will be back at the end of the show for Books of Your Life.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community, from remote banking to TV remotes, call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. RNIB is very proud to work with the Booker Prize Foundation to ensure that shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are available in accessible formats for everyone to enjoy. RNIB Connect Radio's Toby Davey went along to the Booker shortlist party and talked to head judge Neil McGregor.
Hello, and you join me here on RNIB Connect Radio in the middle of Kensington Gardens in London at the Serpentine Pavilion for the launch of the 2022 Booker Prize shortlist.
I'm Neil McGregor, the chair of the judges of the Booker Prize 2022.
And Neil, there's been quite an eclectic list of books and list of authors this year. What do you think about the authors that are on the list? Because as we've got the youngest, we've got the oldest, we've got a few debut authors as well.
I think it shows the enormous range of people and talents writing in English all around the world. I mean, one of the things the Booker Prize is about is simply what can be done with the English language and the different Englishes from all around the world. So in the long list, there are works from Sri Lanka, from Zimbabwe, obviously from Britain and Ireland, but all around the world. People, everyone in the world, are writing in English and thinking about the world in English. That's what the prize is about. How are we today thinking about imagining our world? And what are these creative, imaginative writers saying about the world that we live in now?
Because the world that we do live in at the moment has been quite a strange one, not only with COVID, but cost of living crisis, which is about hitting us at the moment. And obviously lots of writers are writing about that, but are also writing about experiences of their own family as well, when you think of the book, which has cancer as a character. So there's been some very interesting ways of writing.
There have been some really interesting things. There were a large number of books marked, obviously, by the experience of lockdown and living alone and what that did to people. There were also, there was this wonderful book in the long list about cancer, written from the point of view of the cancer in the victim. So you had a double narrative of what's happening to the woman, the heroine, if you like, and the cancer itself speaking. And I think that's very much the result of the way, during the pandemic, people talked about the virus as changing, the virus as attacking, the virus as rethinking. That personification of illness, I think, wouldn't have been possible before the pandemic. But what's most striking, really, I think, about the long list is the extent to which the long history in different countries shapes the way in which characters can move. Whether you're talking about the United States or Ireland or Zimbabwe, it's the long history that shapes now, the long injustice, the questions not answered. And the novels are very much about how individuals now can act in the framework of the past, the weight of the past.
And I know you're obviously just about to announce tonight the shortlist, and I won't ask you about who might be on it, because we should all have to wait about that. But today is National Read a Book Day, and I wondered, is there a particular book that you're reading at the moment which you might recommend to listeners?
I'm afraid there isn't, because for the last 8 months I've been reading 170 books for the Booker Prize. and at the moment, so I think I'm afraid I can't say one thing. But what I can say is that this year, for the first time, the Booker Prize has associated with it book groups from all over the country, book clubs, reading groups. And that's a really interesting fact. For a long time, we thought of reading as the pleasure that you experience sitting alone with a book. But in the last 20, 30 years, this explosion of book groups, people meeting to talk about books, chewing over what they read, and building friendships, reinforcing community in the context of discussing books, that's a great thing, a really great thing.
Well, Neil, thank you very much indeed for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio, and we shall wait to hear who is on the shortlist for the Booker Prize 2022.
Thank you very much. As you know, one of the disconcerting things about the Booker Prize is that the judges are completely free to set their own criteria. What emerged in our conversations was that we were really looking for two things. And in each of the six novels that we've chosen to propose to you, we think we've found them. It was agonising to get from 170 to 13. It was even more difficult to get from the 13 marvellous books on the long list to the six we're about to mention. But in all of the six, we believe that the author has used language not just to tell us what happened, but to create a world, an imagined universe that we as outsiders can enter, can inhabit, can experience and feel as our own. And in that imagined world, something momentous happens to an individual or to a society. They realize who they are and what they can become. And even more important than that, all these books affirm the importance of finding and sharing the truth. That may sound a bit serious, but they also, almost every one of them, will make you laugh at some point. Because these are, above all, books that we have enjoyed. We've read them and we reread them with pleasure. They're books that we want to recommend to others. They're not too long, and that may be evidence
that we're looking not just at great writing, but also at some great editing. And if most of them are about serious, sometimes tragic subjects, then all of them have moments of high humour. They're not easy books, even though they may be short, but like many great pleasures, some require hard work, and we found them well worth the effort. All the book groups that applied talked of the pleasure they found in chewing over books together. We think that with this shortlist, we've given the book groups and you six books that are really worth getting your teeth into. And here they are, in alphabetical order. No Violet Bulawayo, Glory. Percival Everett, The Dreams. Alan Garner, Treacle Walker. Shean Karunatalika, The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida. Claire Keegan, Small Things Like This. And Elizabeth Strout, Oh William. I hope that there's been a clapometer to record all that. And all we would now want to say, I think, all of us, is enjoy them. And we're going to have a very, very tough time choosing the winner. Thank you.
Thanks to Toby Davey. To find out more, you can head to thebookerprizes.com. And now on Read On, a return to Josie Lloyd for the books of her life. Josie, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes. So we'll probably... Can I have two? Is that possible?
Of course.
So the first one is The Child's Garden of Verse by Robert Louis Stevenson. And it's not a novel. It's a book of poems for children. And I really, my mum used to read me poems and would encourage me to read poems off by heart. And my grandmother always used to recite poetry as well. It's kind of like, it's a thing that we kind of don't do now. But I had this kind of really kind of echo of those Victorian eras coming into my childhood, because there was a great love of poetry in our family. And I really loved that feeling of kind of just having a tiny little world in a poem. And actually, I was inspired by a poem to write Life Saving for Beginners, which is Maggie and Millie and Molly and May by E. Cummings, which is quoted at the beginning of the book. And the last two lines are, "For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find in the sea," which I thought was a really beautiful quote for the beginning of the book. So that's the end of that poem. So yes, yeah, so A Child's Garden Verse was a really big one. But then the one that really got me into reading was Virginia Andrews' Flowers in the Attic, which I read when I was about 14 or 15. And it's the most salacious, kind of gripping, outrageous story for a kind of impressionable girl from Essex. I was just absolutely enraptured, and I really, really wanted to be in that whole world of being a writer. So those were the two that really inspired me.
How do you like to go up in a swing, up in the air so blue? Oh, I do think it the pleasantest thing ever a child can do. Up in the air and over the wall, till I can see so wide, rivers and trees and cattle and all over the countryside. Till I look down on the garden green, down on the roof so brown, up in the air I go flying again, up in the air and down.
Truly, when I was very young, way back in the 50s, I believed all of life would be like one long and perfect summer day. After all, it did start out that way. There's not much I can say about our earliest childhood, except that it was very good, and for that I should be everlastingly grateful. We weren't rich, we weren't poor. If we lacked some necessity, I couldn't name it. If we had luxuries, I couldn't name those either without comparing what we had to what others had, and nobody had more or less in our middle-class neighbourhood. In other words, short and simple, we were just ordinary, run-of-the-mill children. Our daddy was a PR man for a large computer manufacturing firm located in Gladstone, Pennsylvania. Population 12,602. He was a huge success, our father. For often his boss dined with us and bragged about the job Daddy seemed to perform so well. "Is that all-American, wholesome, devastatingly good-looking face and charming manner that does them in? Great God in heaven, Chris. What sensible person could resist a fella like you?" Heartily, I agreed with that.
First there was a clip of A Child's Garden of Verses by Robert Louis Stevenson, as narrated by Judith Anderson. It's available commercially, and there are many free readings available both on LibriVox and on YouTube. Secondly, you heard Flowers in the Attic by Virginia Andrews, as read by Nina Holloway. It's available from RNIB Talking Books. It lasts 15 hours and 3 minutes. And Josie, is there a book that on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
It would probably either be I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which I have read about 4 or 5 times in my life, which I find it's like a comfort blanket. I'm not a big rereader, mainly because I've got such a terrible book buying habit, and I've always got teetering piles of books that I don't tend to reread because I'm so aware of all the things that I haven't read and that I really desperately want to read. So, but I've read I Capture the Castle a few times, and I also really love Daphne du Maurier, and My Cousin Rachel is, I mean, it's a toss up between Rebecca and My Cousin Rachel, but I think I would go with My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier.
They used to hang men at Four Turnings in the old days. Not anymore, though. Now, when a murderer pays the penalty for his crime, he does so up at Bodmin, after fair trial at the Assizes. That is, if the law convicts him, before his own conscience kills him. It is better so. Like a surgical operation. And the body has decent burial, though a nameless grave. When I was a child, it was otherwise. I can remember as a little lad seeing a fellow hang in chains where the four roads meet. His face and body were blackened with tar for preservation. He hung there for 5 weeks before they cut him down, and it was the 4th week that I saw him. He swung between earth and sky upon his gibbet, or, as my cousin Ambrose told me, betwixt heaven and hell. Heaven he would never achieve, and the hell that he had known was lost to him. Ambrose prodded at the body with his stick. I can see it now, moving with the wind like a weather vane on a rusty pivot. A poor scarecrow of what had been a man. The rain had rotted his breeches, if not his body, and strips of worsted drooped from his swollen limbs like pulpy paper. It was winter, and some passing joker had placed a sprig of holly in the torn vest for celebration. Somehow, at 7 years old, that seemed to me the final outrage, but I said nothing. Ambrose must have taken me there for a purpose, perhaps to test my nerve, to see if I would run away, or laugh, or cry. As my guardian, father, brother, counselor, as in fact my whole world, he was forever testing me.
Jonathan Price reading My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier, as available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. As is I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, as read by Candida Gubbins. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Oh, yes. Elif Shafak's The Island of Missing Trees, which is a magical and beautiful book. And I've just been on holiday in Mallorca, and in the garden, there were a lot of fig trees. And it's a fabulous book because it's about Cyprus, and it's about the kind of Greek-Turkish conflict. And it's set in Cyprus in the 70s and in London now. But it's also narrated partly by a tree. So part of the narration is from the point of view of a fig tree, which I thought was just tremendous, and it's a beautiful book. And it's just steeped in this wonderful love story, and it's just gorgeous. So I love her writing anyway, but yeah, I would really recommend that. Elif Shafak's The Island of Missing Trees.
This afternoon, as storm clouds descended over London and the world turned the colour of melancholy, Kostas Kazantzakis buried me in the garden. In the back garden, that is. Normally, I liked it here, among the lush camellias, sweetly fragrant honeysuckles, and witch hazels with their spidery flowers. But this was no normal day. I tried to cheer up and see the bright side of things. Not that it helped. I was nervous, filled with apprehension. I had never been buried before. Kostas had been toiling outside in the cold since the early hours. A light sheen of sweat had formed on his brow, and it glistened every time he forced the steel edge of the spade into solid earth. Behind him extended the shadows of the wooden trellises that in summer were covered with climbing roses and clematis vines, but were now no more than a see-through barrier separating our garden from the neighbour's terrace. Slowly accumulating beside his leather boots, alongside the silvery trail left by his nail, was a pile of soil, clammy and crumbling to the touch. His breath clouded in front of his face. His shoulders were taut inside his navy parka, the one he had bought from a vintage shop on Portobello Road, and his knuckles were red and raw, slightly bleeding. But he didn't seem to notice. I was cold, and though I did not want to admit it to myself, frightened. I wished I could have shared my worries with him. But even if I could have spoken, he was too distracted to hear me, absorbed in his own thoughts as he kept digging without so much as a glance in my direction. When he was done, he would put the spade aside, look at me with those sage-green eyes that I knew had seen things both pleasant and painful, and push me down into the hollow ground.
The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak is narrated by both Daphne Kuma and Amira Ghazala. It's available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Josie Lloyd, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today's show. I'll be back at the same time next week with more book news, reviews and author interviews. And remember, you can join me every day of the week on Talking Books. First at 7 in the morning, then there's a different tale on at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. So farewell until next week, and remember to read on.